Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax reform to the EU's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can find me on Twitter at xbordertax. On this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks, we're in our D.C. studio, where I'm excited to be joined by Nils Cousin. Nils is a director in our Washington National Tax Services practice, focusing on international taxation with a heavy emphasis on inbound to the U.S. Nils, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a particular topic that I'm very excited about. Long-awaited regulations on Section 245 Cap A, which is the dividends received deduction that now applies to our quote-unquote territorial system. And we spent a bunch of time talking about whether we have a territorial or a worldwide system. And so we'll leave that for another debate. But we at least now have some regs on how to apply the new DRD on dividends from our foreign subsidiaries. And also, very interestingly, as part of the same reg package, we got regs on 267 Cap A, which is the US's jump into the OECD base erosion and profit shifting rules. So let's start, Nils, with 245 Cap A. Tell us a little bit about just the statutory framework before we dive into the proposed regs.
Sure, absolutely. And I think one thing to remember here is that these are actually not going to be comprehensive regulations on 245 Cap A. They deal with only a small aspect of 245 Cap A. So 245 Cap A generally is, as you already said, the dividends received deduction that gives U.S. shareholders of CFCs 100% DRD for dividends that are attributable to foreign source income of those CFCs. So that's what we're calling the territorial system, although, of course, we still have subpart F and we have GILTI, so it's a limited territorial system.
Right.
245 Cap AE has a anti-abuse rule of sorts. And what that rule basically says is that the DRD will not be available to the extent that the dividend gives rise to a hybrid deduction. So that what that means is if the payment that is characterized as a dividend for U.S. tax purposes is treated as a deductible payment for foreign law tax purposes, then 245 Cap A DRD does not apply.
And so the regs then gave us some guidance with respect to how we determine whether we have this type of hybrid instrument, right? That is equity for U.S. and then debt or deductible for local. But what did that? How did the regs add to this analysis?
Sure. So the first thing is the regs do follow, then do track the way that 245 Cap E works generally. There are two big highlights, I think, that are very important for the regs. And one is the definition of what's a hybrid deduction. And that is actually somewhat broader in a very significant way than the potential definitions that Treasury and IRS could have come up with. And the important way in which it's broader is that in addition to actual payments on a distribution that would be treated as deductible in the country of the CFC, for example, distributions on a PPL that the home jurisdiction treats as debt.
And a PPL being a profit participating loan,
yes,
which is relatively common investment vehicle, for example, to a number of European countries, where we would say, well, it's equity for U.S. federal income tax purposes because the yield on that instrument is related to the underlying profit of that entity, but where the local jurisdiction would generally give a deduction on that profit participating loan.
Right, exactly. So everyone knew that those were going to be in scope, and they are. But the big expansion here is that notional interest deductions with respect to equity that are not actually linked to any particular payment made on a share of stock or a share of equity are also treated as hybrid deductions that can give rise to a DRD disallowance to the U.S. shareholder.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of examples of that around the world. Two that come to mind are in Italy. Italy generally has a notional interest deduction. And for those less familiar with the notional interest deduction, generally when you put equity into an Italian entity, a certain portion of that equity, you get a notional interest deduction. And I think from a policy perspective, certain jurisdictions didn't want you to lever up, you know, through actual debt. And the thought is that, well, if you just put in equity, we'll give a notional interest deduction. So instead of levering up through, you know, traditional debt, then you get a deduction, you know, on that equity. The other jurisdiction that, I mean, again, there are a number, but the other one is the interest on equity in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, similarly, different structure generally or different rules generally, but that to the extent that you have equity in Brazil, there is an interest on equity component where you get a deduction. Mm-hmm. And I the issue, I guess, then is that to the extent that there are distributions from Italy, for example, or from Brazil, then those deductions may not qualify for 245 Cap A. And before we kind of dive into that, I do want to remind our listeners that there is a lot of PTAP down in the structures, such that we have, you know, 965 PTAP, we're going to have PTAP from GILTI. So whether we actually dive into the 245 Cap A, that may not be a practical issue from a cash perspective, but then as we start thinking about dispositions and 1248, it certainly can become an issue.
Right. Yeah, agree with that, absolutely. And so another thing that's really that these regulations did, or these proposed regulations, I should say, they're not finalized, is they create this concept of essentially a hybrid deduction account. And what that basically means is, I think they're concerned that if you make a distribution in a year, that you would only be looking at hybrid deductions that occur in that year. But these regulations actually require you to track and set up these hybrid deduction accounts with respect to each share of stock that you have in the CFC. And so the way that works is if a hybrid deduction relates very specifically to a share of stock, for example, if you have one of these profit participating loans and the deduction is, you know, is with respect to a payment that you make on that share, then that payment, that hybrid deduction would track to that particular share of stock. With something like a notional interest deduction that doesn't attach to a particular payment on a share of stock, you do it pro rata based on the value of the different types of shares of stock. But what you could have is, for example, a company that has notional interest deductions of $20 in years 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then in years 1, 2, and 3, there's no payment out of any dividends. In year 4, you pay out a $100 dividend. Well, at that point, you've got $80 in your hybrid deduction account. That means $80 of the dividend would be ineligible for the DRD.
And let's talk a little bit about the eligibility for the DRD, because I think normally we would think about it as first tier. Mm-hmm. Right. So in other words, first tier underneath the U.S. So to the extent to go back to, we have our Brazilian subsidiary or Italian subsidiary sitting underneath the U.S. and we're making 245, making a dividend distribution. Maybe we've gotten through all the PTAP. Now we have some untaxed earnings and profits from a 10% return on our depreciable tangible assets, and we're bringing that back. Mm-hmm. But this also applies lower tier. Right. And so talk about how those rules work when you have a lower tier distribution, because at least under today's rules, we actually have 954C6 look through. So a dividend from, let's say, CFC2 to CFC1 before it comes to the U.S. would generally qualify for look through if CFC2, in my example, is a Brazilian or an Italian entity.
So we've got these tiering rules where dividends are being paid from a lower tier CFC to an upper tier CFC. And if the lower tier CFC dividend is a hybrid dividend, meaning that if it were paid directly to the U.S. shareholder, it would be subject to disallowance under these hybrid dividend rules, then that's still treated as a lower tier to higher tier CFC hybrid dividend. And those hybrid dividends paid to an upper tier CFC are going to be treated as subpart F income to the U.S. shareholder.
Yeah. And even though 954C6 look through would otherwise apply, I think these proposed regs, right, turn off 954C6.
Correct.
And so I think this one is just very interesting. I mean, it's been a common theme of the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast as we've gone through U.S. tax reform and these rules. This is just the hybrid deduction account. So obviously applicable to those first tier subsidiaries, but to the extent that you've got lower tier subsidiaries with any type of one of these hybrid instruments as defined in the 245 Cap A rules, that you'll need to think through these hybrid deduction accounts because they could exist mm-hmm. throughout the entire structure.
Yeah, and something else that we need to keep in mind and why is this particularly insidious is that you got the subpart F income, but when you have one of these hybrid dividends that's subject to these disallowance rules, you don't get any foreign tax credits for any income tax that's associated with that either. And so, you know, as you said, plenty of companies have plenty of PTAP. You may otherwise not have any earnings and profits. And of course, this doesn't apply to return of basis distributions or anything like that. But the ultimate result could well be that companies in countries that, for example, do give notional interest deductions are going to have trapped cash. And so, you know, either there's just no territoriality at all with respect to those subsidiaries, or, you know, and you're not necessarily going to be as incentivized to bring your earnings and profits back to the U.S.
That's right. And it's a great point that you don't get the foreign tax credits on the subpart F in my example, where U.S. owns CFC1, which owns CFC2. CFC1 does not get the foreign tax credits, or the way we used to think about it under the old, you know, 902 and old 960. We don't get those foreign tax credits. So that's an important point. I think, Nils, that one of the other things that's really interesting as somebody who spent some time doing a lot of deals is that, you know, this tracking mechanism now, I mean, it has to be done at the CFC level, right? Mm-hmm. And then so what happens if, you know, CFC2, which has the notional interest deduction, is then sold to a third party? Then I think that that hybrid deduction account is at the CFC.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, of course, if you've got 1248 type of issues and things like that, then, you know, you could have to deal with it there at the shareholder level as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where I was going next. And so, you know, if, for example, we had a bunch of untaxed DNP because it was trapped in there, and, you know, the hybrid deduction account effectively gets triggered as a result of either a 1248 inclusion, if it's a first tier subsidiary, or lower tier, that and under 964, E, then that all of a sudden creates this additional inclusion with no FTCs potentially. And so it could, you know, at the 21% rate, it's not guilty. It's going to be something that everybody who's looking at deals, and particularly dispositions, that we need to start thinking about as far as how these hybrid deduction accounts are tracked, and then what it can mean potentially to the deal environment.
Right.
All right. So let's turn now to 267 Cap A. And, you know, I'm somebody who has spent quite a bit of time over the last however many years thinking about BEPS Action Item 2. It's been fascinating to see the way the global tax system, if you will, has evolved since that original OECD report. We've seen the UK were the first ones that came out with the specific anti-hybrid rules. The EU has now required, effective as of January 1st of 2019, for these Action Item 2 intra-EU payments to apply. By the end of this year, more specifically on January 1st, 2020, all 28 member states, assuming there are still 28 member states, will be required to, the one that might leave is already adopted, but all the other member states will be required to adopt anti-hybrid rules. And so the U.S. has now officially jumped on the bandwagon. So maybe we start with the statute, because the statute was relatively narrow as far as what it applied to. And then we had the regs then really broadened that out. But maybe you start with the statute.
Sure. And so this is kind of my favorite one of all the tax reform statutes to talk about as an inbound guy. And part of it is, you know, when tax reform came in, we had all these things that get a lot of attention, 163J, BEAT, and rightfully so. They deserve the attention. And this 267 Cap A was the short little two-page statute, I think, maybe three in the legislative text, where it's all double-spaced. And you could see that it was basically trying to do what the BEPS Action 2 was going after. But there was also the drafting, I think, you know, needed quite a bit of clarification regulations as to how this would actually apply. And so as a result of that, when this came out, everyone focused on BEAT, everyone focused on 163J. And a few of us were just saying all along, it's like, okay, but when these regs come out, they're going to be a pretty big deal. You know, and I think we found that certainly 163J touches a lot of different areas. People focus a lot on BEAT. But of all those packages that came out, and then this one came out, this is the one that I think had us having quite a few calls, trying to understand how things are impacted, you know, over the holiday break and everything.
Right.
And so it is pretty fascinating. There's a lot in these regs. And so the first thing, the basic point of the statute is that it would apply to disallow a deduction for payments of interest or royalties that are made by a corporation to a foreign related party if two things are the case. And the first would be that the foreign related party does not have an income inclusion with respect to that payment. And that could be a result of just having an exclusion from income, or could be the result of having a deduction available with respect to that payment. You earn income, but you get an offsetting deduction. The second condition that needed to be satisfied for the deduction to be denied is that the payment must be a result either transaction, which in the statute is defined as a transaction with respect to which a payment we would treat as interest or royalties in the U.S., but would be treated as something different, for example, a dividend in the country of receipt.
Kind of like the opposite of the 245 cap A, right?
Exactly.
Where the U.S. treats it as interest, for example, like the profit participating loan, for example, which is not relevant from a U.S. perspective. But the concept being that we have something that the foreign jurisdiction might treat as equity, the U.S. treats as debt, get an interest expense on the debt, and then the foreign jurisdiction may give a participation exemption, for example, on the payment and not subject it to tax.
Absolutely. That's exactly it, right? And then the other way you could satisfy the second requirement and be disallowed a deduction is if the payment was made by or to a hybrid entity. So an entity that's transparent in one jurisdiction and non-transparent in the other relevant jurisdiction. And so there are a lot of questions about how you define transparency, how you define hybridity, what's a hybrid payment, what does it mean to not include a payment? And these regulations try to provide some mechanisms to answer that. But there was also in the statute quite a bit of authority for Treasury and the IRS to expand the reach of those of 267 cap A to things that weren't necessarily contemplated or weren't necessarily spelled out in the statute.
Right.
Ones that come to mind that I think people were focused on before the regs came out and are certainly going to be focused on now are arrangements that would sort of have a conduit character to them, arrangements that use branch structures, and then this very broad authority to deal with any type of structured arrangement.
Yeah, and this is, the term that is used within the OECD rules is these imported mismatch rules. And so to your point, it's really a kind of a conduit, a back-to-back type of arrangement that would potentially get that foreign jurisdiction to a similar result as a potential deduction no inclusion, which is the terminology that's used in the regs, for example, where the U.S. gets a deduction and there's no corresponding inclusion in the foreign jurisdiction. But maybe before we dive into some of those specifics, I think the effective dates are something that's really, really important for taxpayers to consider. And there is an element of these regs, and this has been fascinating with the whole reg packages that we've seen to date, as far as effective dates being, after proposed regs or after final regs or effective January 1st, 2018, when the TCJA first came into force. But how were these regs broken down from an effective date perspective?
Sure. So similar to some of the other regs that are part of the new provisions that were enacted as part of the TCJA, the general rule is that these regs are retroactive to the effective date of the provision. So in this case, that would be taxable years beginning after December 31, 2017. There's a specific rule because by statute, they can only make regulations retroactive to the effective date of the statute if they are finalized within 18 months of that effective date. So there's this, if somehow we don't manage to finalize these until June 2019, then they're not going to be retroactively
effective back to January 1st, 2018.
Right. But generally they are. The rules, however, that are the sort of expansion of the statute, as I would call it, pursuant to that regulatory grant authority, which, there are rules on branch mismatches, on disregard of payments, branch payments, reverse hybrids, and imported mismatches. Those rules are not retroactive. They are prospective. But they are applicable to tax years beginning on or after December 20, 2018. So while they're only prospective, and while it's great to say that, okay, someone who might have had one of these structures in 2017, if you're a calendar year taxpayer, those rules are applicable now that we are in 2019.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if certain taxpayers comment that maybe the effective date would be more appropriate from the date that the final regs are issued, because, companies didn't know what these rules were and now are obviously scrambling to understand what the rules are that are now applying today, when we didn't know, obviously, before those proposed regulations were adopted.
Sure. Yeah, and although one thing I'll comment on that is You know, sort of what I've seen is that there seems to be a little bit more reticence to comment on these regulations. And part of that is because, you know, we've got all the BEPS Action 2 stuff. And from a policy perspective, you know, that you could see where a lot of these rules come from. And so people aren't really trying to be, aren't as eager to be out there and say, we think these rules are terrible, you should let us have hybrid mismatches, right? On the other hand, there are a number of places in which I think these regulations still have some issues with them, in which they go beyond what the BEPS Action 2 is trying to do, or in which they might otherwise be sort of overbroad. So I'm curious to see just how many folks are going to comment on those, at least those specific provisions.
It's a great point. It is more of a sensitive area, particularly given the focus globally and particularly with the OECD and the EU. So let's start then with the, what did the regs tell us that on the effect that is effective January 1st, 2018? So to the extent that we want to call it retroactive, you know, what do those regs tell us? What should companies and people be mindful of as they're analyzing their 2018 positions?
So I'll start with some good news, actually, right? People were very, very worried about the fact that these regs would apply not just to U.S. companies making payments to foreign affiliates, but they would also apply to CFCs. And that, you know, again, we're going to add a lot of complexity to CFCs figuring out their subpart F income and having to deal with these hybrid deductions. The regulations do substantially limit the extent to which CFCs are going to have to worry about these. And they do that by providing that any CFC to CFC payments and any CFC to U.S. shareholder payments are not going to be subject to these regulations. So that's helpful. It prevents a lot of complexity, prevents potential whipsaws. CFCs aren't completely out. If you have a sort of sandwich structure, a foreign parent, U.S. sub, and CFC sub, payments from the CFC that hopscotch the immediate U.S. parent and go straight to the foreign parent, those are potentially still within the scope. So you do still have to worry about those.
Yeah, and I think the regs tell us that the income actually needs to be included in the U.S., right?
Yes.
To be able to fall outside of 267 Cap A. So in other words, that the income either has to be included in subpart F, and that was explicit in the statute, right? If there was an inclusion that was a part of our historic, our old subpart F regime, that was outside of 267 Cap A. We were wondering whether 267 Cap A would apply for GILTI purposes, right? For purposes of computing our tested income. And 951 Cap A was not in the statute. And I think most of our U.S. multinationals are those with the foreign parented structures that had CFCs underneath the U.S. and CFC to CFC payments. It was welcome news to know that, well, if it's included in GILTI or if it's included in subpart F, then it shouldn't be subject to 267A as long as that amount is actually included in the U.S.
Yeah, and that rule actually goes even broader, because here we have, even when a U.S. Company is making a payment outbound to a foreign affiliate, the type of stuff that's clearly within 267 Cap A, and you know there might be a no inclusion in the foreign country, so you worry about these rules, right? We always had the rule that says, yeah, but if that income... Sure, if there's no inclusion in the foreign country, but if that's a CFC itself and it's actually included in subpart F income of the U.S. shareholder, then the U.S. company doesn't lose its deduction. That they did expand to cover not only payments that are going to be included in GILTI tested income of the U.S. shareholder, but they also included payments that would otherwise be subject to U.S. tax to U.S. net income tax at the level of that foreign affiliate. So if it's not included by the foreign affiliate in its country of organization, but it's actually ECI for U.S. tax purposes, or in the case of a affiliate that's treaty eligible, is attributable to a U.S. PE, so that U.S. tax is imposed on the payment side, then the deduction isn't lost. Interestingly, though, they did not provide for an exemption if the payment is subject to U.S. withholding tax. So you could be making a payment that's subject to full 30% U.S. withholding tax, and you could lose the deduction on that payment as well.
Yeah, great point. That would be a big whipsaw. So we talked about the good news on the for the CFCs underneath the U.S., but what other highlights on those provisions that apply from January 1st?
So other highlights on those really is that, you know, the vocabulary here is very different from the statute. I said earlier that the statute left quite a bit that needed to be clarified in terms of how you actually apply these rules and how do you define a hybrid entity. So they have a lot of rules on that I think generally try to give effect to what the BEPS proposal is trying to go after. So you already mentioned this sort of deduction, no inclusion concept, right? So D/NI is the new acronym that's in these proposed regulations. And so they provide, first, these rules cannot apply to deny a deduction unless you have a deduction, no inclusion. They are pretty broad about what could be a non-inclusion. They do provide for a proportional rule. So you don't have to have a full non-inclusion, even if you have a partial non-inclusion. A reduction in the sort of ordinary income tax rate, you could get denied a partial deduction. And so I think the standard example of that is if a U.S. company makes a payment to a foreign affiliate and it's treated as debt for U.S. purposes, so we give an interest deduction, but it's treated as a dividend return on equity for recipient law tax purposes, and there's a participation exemption. If the participation exemption is a full exemption, then the U.S. company just loses it entirely. On the other hand, if the participation exemption is a partial exemption, so that let's say you're still paying 20% of what your normal tax rate would be in that country, then you would be partially denied the deduction. In my example, you'd be denied 80% of the deduction. So that's one important thing to note. Something else is, under the statute, you have those two requirements. You have the deduction no inclusion requirement and you have the hybridity requirement, but they're not really linked under the statute. So there were all kinds of weird structures we were coming up with and questions we were coming up with where, depending on which entity you tested, you might be in these rules, but maybe you shouldn't be from a policy perspective. They have linked those two together. And so they have said the deduction no inclusion result, or the no inclusion result at least, needs to be a result of hybridity. So whether it's the instrument or whether it's the entities that are hybrids.
All right. So, that is in a nutshell, I think, from what is effective January 1st on those specific rules that were in the original statute. And then, as you mentioned, there was a whole list of, I think it was 8 or 9 enumerated items that the Congress gave Treasury specific regulatory authority to address. And this is where things get significantly more complicated. And so, we're not obviously going to get into some of the mechanics of those particular rules. After December 20th, trying to look and apply those rules, how did they break it down as far as the type of transactions that may be subject to, or the type of payments on interest or royalties that may be subject to 267 Cap A?
Sure. So a few rules. There's a rule on disregarded payments that's new and that's prospective. And in a nutshell, what that does is it would deal with the type of payment where, for example, you have a foreign company that owns a U.S. company where the U.S. company is a corporation for U.S. purposes, but disregarded for foreign tax purposes, and the U.S. company pays interest out to its parent or royalties, and that's a disregarded payment for foreign law tax purposes. So they have rules that say there's a no inclusion there to the foreign parent as a result of the payment being disregarded for foreign law purposes, and so there's a potential that you lose the deduction there with at least to the extent that you're not double paying on other regarded income in both the U.S. and the other country. There are what's called branch mismatch payments, and what those basically say is that if your U.S. person is making a payment of interest or royalties to an offshore branch, if it's foreign affiliate, to the extent that neither the branch jurisdiction nor the home office jurisdiction takes that income into account, you will be denied a deduction for that. That's a prospective rule. There is a very important imported mismatch rule. And what that basically says is if you're making a payment to your foreign affiliate, even if that payment is just, it's debt for U.S. tax purposes, it's debt for foreign tax purposes, there's nothing going on. To the extent that the foreign affiliate itself has gets a deduction for a type of transaction that would be disallowed if the foreign jurisdiction had rules that were substantially similar to these U.S. rules, then that's treated as a imported mismatch. And here again, we have a specific rule that essentially treats a notional interest deduction as automatically giving rise to an imported mismatch.
Yeah. So for example, any payment from the U.S. then to a foreign affiliate that has a notional interest deduction is an issue. Anytime we have an interest or royalty payment, it's not just enough to stop at the recipient. Then you need to look through. And this is very consistent with the OECD's imported mismatch rule. Frankly, it's a conduit type theory, back to back, call it what you want. Imported mismatch is just kind of the fancy way, I think, to describe it, but really requires taxpayers to have to look through and then do that same analysis, but at the foreign affiliate level. There are a couple of other provisions too that I noted. Deemed branch payments, I thought, it was interesting, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about the deemed branch payments and the reverse hybrid payments. So payments to reverse hybrids are also caught, but I think those are the other two with maybe less applicability, but still is just as much importance.
Right, and so deemed branch payments would be where a non-U.S. company has a U.S. permanent establishment, right? And so it's got income that's attributable to that U.S. permanent establishment, and in being allowed to figure out its net income attributable thereto, it can get deductions for certain deemed interest or royalty payments back to the home office. And so even though those are technically disregarded payments, they're not disregarded for purposes of figuring out the net income tax in the U.S. And so there is really a deduction that's given there. And there are rules under these regulations that say the deduction could effectively be disallowed unless there is a corresponding income inclusion in the home office country for its tax purposes. Reverse hybrids. The reverse hybrid rules are funny. So we when talking about them, the first thing we need to do is let go of our conventional concept of a reverse hybrid, mm-hmm. where we say it's treated as a corporation for U.S. tax purposes and as transparent for local law tax purposes. U.S. tax treatment doesn't matter here. It really deals with any entity that's transparent for local law tax purposes, but opaque for purposes of the tax law of any investor in that mm-hmm. entity. And generally speaking, we only care about investors that themselves would be related parties to the payor of the income, unless we're dealing with a structured arrangement. But ultimately, if you're in these rules, any payment that you make to to the reverse hybrid, if it's a related reverse hybrid, is going to be disallowed, except to the extent that investors in that reverse hybrid do currently take the amount into income and take it into amount as interest or royalties, as something that's actually subject to tax. That's not a dividend that's eligible for a participation exemption in that country.
That's right. And so I think, some of the other important points just to point out that we see in the regs is broad definition of interest, right? And this is very consistent, maybe not quite as broad as 163J, but
generally in line with that.
Generally in line with, deductible payments related to time value of money. Relatively broad definition of royalty. So it's important for payers to really think about, what are all those deductible type of payments. There was also an avoidance rule, as well as some potential changes to the DCL rules. Mm-hmm. Any specific comments on any of those?
Well, the DCL rule, definitely, because that one kind of came out of left field, right? I mean, everyone was expecting that you're going to have these anti-hybrid regs giving effect to the statute. But the DCL rule is really a change in the check-the-box regulations. And what the preamble to these regulations states is that Treasury and the IRS are concerned that taxpayers could be using entities that are treated as corporations for U.S. tax purposes and as flow-through for local law or other law tax purposes to take what the IRS perceives to be sort of an end run around the DCL rules. They think from a policy perspective, those types of entities should be subject to the DCL rules, but people take the positions that they're not. The DCL rules don't cover that. And so the change that we have here is that as a condition of making a check-the-box election on one of these entities to treat it as I described, you're going to need to be consenting to have that entity be subject to the DCL rules. So that regulation is also applicable to any taxable years beginning after 12/20/2018. Mm-hmm. However, there's a transition rule for existing entities that have already made those check-the-box elections, and those essentially are given a 12-month grace period to either elect to no longer be reverse hybrid, and here I'm using reverse hybrid in the classic sense, or they would then be deemed to consent to that treatment.
Yeah, very interesting how they structured that from a timing perspective. Well, Nils, I think this is probably the first of hopefully a number of podcasts and discussions we'll have. These are some really deep and technical regulations, and will be interesting to see what comments taxpayers put forth, and then ultimately what, if any, changes that we see in the final regs. Well, thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks. Thanks again to Nils Cousin, a director in PwC's WNTS practice focusing on inbound international taxation. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's international tax services leader in the U.S. You can follow me on Twitter at XBorderTax and LinkedIn at Doug McConey. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast.